This is Steve Wedrock of the office at the office of retired Roman Catholic Auxiliary Bishop Thomas Gumbleton in Detroit, Michigan. Today is Wednesday, May 8th, 2013, and we are discussing the Detroit newspaper worker strike and Bishop Gumbleton's role as a Catholic priest, parish pastor, auxiliary bishop, and community activist. Your Excellency, I'd like to begin by asking you about your personal background. Where were you born?
9961 Manor. Detroit, Michigan.
Okay.
I was born at home in Detroit.
Okay. And where did you grow up?
In Detroit.
Same area?
My whole life has been in Detroit except when I was away at school.
Okay. And where did you go to school?
Elementary school was the Epiphany Parish School, and then ninth grade I entered Sacred Heart Seminary for high school. Continued through college and then went to St. John's Provincial Seminary for the last 4 years of preparation. And subsequently, I obtained a doctorate in canon law at the Pontifical Lateran University in Rome.
And St. John's Provincial was in Plymouth?
That's in Plymouth, Michigan, yes.
And other than Detroit, you've lived in Rome, obviously. Anywhere else?
For 3 years in Rome. Okay. No, but that's all. Otherwise, I have lived in Detroit, basically in this neighborhood. Where we are right now is, well, just about two parishes over from Epiphany. Mm-hmm. I mean, so it's three, four miles away. And where I live is in Corktown, so that's same west side Detroit.
Right, still in this area, absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you have any siblings?
Oh, yes, there were nine of us.
Okay. And what did they do for a living, or what did they do for a living?
Well, a variety of things. Let's see. My oldest brother worked for Shed Bardish Hostess, or Shed Hostess Bardish, whatever it was, in Detroit. It was, they produced mayonnaise and food products. And then my oldest sister actually was damaged at birth, her brain, and so she was institutionalized from the time she was about 12. And she just died this past summer.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, so she lived to be 90.
Good long life, though.
Yeah. But then my next brother was a certified public accountant, worked for the big one, Plant Moran. Yeah, and my next brother was a general sales manager for General Mills, and my next brother was a school teacher in South Redford School District. He taught middle school. And my next brother was a research engineer for General Motors. And my youngest brother was in social work, basically. He got his MSW from Wayne State University.
It's good school.
Yeah.
growing up in Detroit, what was your knowledge of incidents like the Flint sit-down strike and the Flint sit-down strike in the 30s
A bit too young to know about that. When that happened, I was 6-7 years old, and so I wasn't aware of that at the time.
Did you grow up? Was it ever spoken about? I know you were a pastor in Dearborn as well.
Yeah.
At St. Alphonsus.
Yes.
I mean, was it ever spoken about? It was the bridge incident in Dearborn at the Rouge plant.
Yeah. Not so much then. As I got to know many union leaders, I
certainly learned about
heard
it.
A lot more about it. And I read about it later on and was aware of all that happened. I got to know Walter Reuther quite well. Mm-hmm. And he, of course, was very much part of that.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah. And I want to tell you too, since we're going to be talking about the Detroit News Agency, I peddled Detroit newspapers when I was a child. In fact, we had a Detroit news route that was on Manor. Our home, the street where I lived, and it was three blocks from West Chicago to Plymouth, and we had about 100 customers. So, and I say we because it started, my two older brothers had it first, then I had it.
Yeah, it's a family affair.
Yeah, so we just, because it was a perfect newspaper route.
Right.
You could ride up and down those three blocks on your bicycle and peddle all the papers in less than 20 minutes.
Yeah.
So it was a good deal. Good.
And how old were you when you did that?
Well, I probably started my turn at peddling when I was in the sixth grade.
Okay.
So I'd be 12.
Okay. And who were your influences prior to your entrance into the seminary?
Oh, that came from the parish school and the church. I was an altar boy.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, actually, for some reason, I was thinking about this morning, I don't know why, but it was on a Holy Thursday, the Thursday of the Last Supper, and I'd served Mass in the morning, and I was probably in the fifth or sixth grade, and I remember after church on Holy Thursday, talking with my mother about the fact that I probably would go to the seminary.
And people went younger then, I think.
Well, yes. I entered the seminary in the ninth grade.
Right.
So, but I'd been thinking about it for two or three years before that, and made the final decision in the eighth grade. Because you had to sign up for what high school you were going to go, if you're going to go to a Catholic high school.
Right.
From Epiphany, we didn't have a high school, so most of the boys went either to Catholic Central or to U of D.
Mm-hmm.
My older brothers my younger brothers too went to Catholic Central. But I was the exception. I went to Sacred Heart Seminary.
Right.
Yeah.
The exception.
Yeah.
At what parishes did you serve during your career as a Catholic priest?
First St. Alphonsus in Dearborn. That was 1956 to 1960. Then, after that, for a few years, I was doing weekend work because I was assigned to the chantry office.
Right.
And lived in a parish, but did parish ministry on the weekends,
mm-hmm.
basically. And worked in the administrative offices of the diocese during the week. I was in the assigned to the chantry office in 1960, and then about 14 months later, that was in June, then in September of 61 is when I went to Rome for school and came back in 64, and then began living. At that point, I lived at Madonna Parish on Oakman and 12th Street. And
Cunningham's Parish, right?
Not at that time.
Not yet.
Subsequently, it was Father Charlie O'Neill was the pastor then. And it was somebody I knew, and it was a real friendly person. And it was, I picked a parish to live in that would be convenient for going back and forth to the chantry.
Right.
And of course, that's just off of the Lodge Freeway,
mm-hmm.
at 12th Street,
right.
and at Davison. And so it was a 10-minute ride back and forth.
And close to Sacred Heart as well, the seminary.
Yeah. And so I lived there until 67, the late summer of 1967. There was a parish on the east side, northeast side, called Holy Ghost. And it was staffed by the Holy Ghost Fathers. And they pulled out that summer of 67. And I was still full-time at the chantry, but I wanted to get back into parish work, so I became the pastor of that parish. But it only lasted maybe 8 or 9 months, because in May of 68, I was ordained an auxiliary bishop, and so then I had to give up the parish because I was going to be expected to circulate among all the parishes. And so I was no longer the pastor at Holy Ghost after that. And but then in about 1973, I felt the need to get back into a parish, and so I was able to become pastor of St. Aloysius Parish in downtown Detroit.
Which is next to the chancery.
Yeah, yeah. So it was easy to take care of that parish and keep working in the right. chancery office. And so that lasted for about, until about 1977, I think it was, or 78. When we established regions for the diocese. And so as a regional bishop, I was given more responsibility for a certain area of the diocese, and the expectation was to get to know those parishes well, the priests in those parishes and the people. And so again, I gave up the parish and got myself established in what we call the West region of the diocese. And but then again, 1983, St. Leo Parish became open, again, because it was staffed by a religious order. Mm-hmm. Well, the Immaculate Heart of Mary priests left here probably about 81, and another religious order took it over for a while, the White Fathers, they were called. But that didn't work, and so by 83, we had no pastor here. And it was in my region, and I was responsible for finding a pastor, so I decided I would do it.
You got a good one, right?
If the people would accept me. And so I met with them ahead of time and talked it over, and one of the people said, well, we'll never see you. And I said, well, yeah, if I take it on, I'll be here every weekend, certainly, and then during the week. But I might be out doing other things also, because I was still working at the chancery. Right. And so I became pastor here and was here till I think 2007 it was, or 6, 7.
Which is when you retired, right?
Well, when I got kicked out.
Right.
Yeah, 2007, I think. And so that were all the parishes that I served in.
And did you have associates? Well, as a pastor, did you have associate priests with you?
No.
Just you here at St. Leo's, huh?
Yeah, by that time, not many parishes had associates. Yeah. You know, the big exodus started in the middle 60s and through the 70s, and so we lost a lot of priests, plus regular retirements and people dying, but also priests were leaving, and so more and more parishes were staffed by one person.
Right.
So every place I was, I was the only one.
That's a lot of work for one person, certainly.
Well, sort of. I mean, you had lay staff and pastoral associates who were not ordained.
Right.
Yeah, so that was a good development on its own.
Yeah. Your motto on your Episcopal coat of arms translates to be doers of the world.
Correct.
How has that influenced or directed your ministry?
Well, by the time I was appointed as a bishop, I was an activist in the priesthood already. You know, I had been involved in anti-war movement, and I guess that probably was the most important thing, the anti-Vietnam War. But also got involved in organization Bread for the World. I was the president of that for a while, and that was kind of an activist organization. And I was social justice issues I got involved in quite a bit. And, you know, when I got named a bishop, I had no idea what you had to do to become a bishop. But one of the things, you had to get a coat of arms. So there was a priest in the diocese, Bonin Kosicki, who knew all about how you make coats of arms, because there's something, you know, a certain number of things you have to put in.
Right.
I mean, it's supposed to, I think, relate to your family, to your city or something like that. Yeah. So he designed it, but then you had to get a motto. And frankly, I didn't know what to get. And it was amazing. I took the big National Catholic Directory, and I opened it up to, you know, see what other bishops had as models. I'm just going to take one, find one I liked and take it. Well, the first one I came to was Anchorage, Alaska. And that bishop had Espote Factoris Verbum Domini, Tours of the Word. I said, hey, that fits.
Yeah. So
I took it.
It's divine intervention, you found that one, huh?
Yeah. So I didn't have to look any further. So I thought, oh, well, I'd like that. You know, be active, be doers.
It's certainly
not just hearers of the word, but doers of the word. And so I took it.
Yeah. Other than pastor and auxiliary bishop, in what other capacities have you served in the Archdiocese?
Oh, I started off at the Chancery as an assistant chancellor. The chancellor was it's in the U.S. system, not so much at canon law itself, but the chancellor in the U.S. dioceses was, well, I should say first, that technically in canon law, the chancellor is like the record keeper, and, you know.
The archivist.
Archivist, and, you know, the person who had to make sure documents were signed properly and all that sort of thing. But in the U.S., the chancellor became like the assistant, major assistant to the bishop of the diocese. Mm-hmm. And it was through the chancery office that appointments were made, parishes were established, and, you know, all the oversight of the diocese that the bishop is responsible for, the main assistant he had would be the chancellor. And so I was an assistant chancellor. There were three of us, actually, at that point when I was assigned. But I was only there for 14 months or so before I went off to school. And when I came back, I was an assistant chancellor again, but by 1965, I became the vice chancellor, which is, vice president,
right.
Vice chancellor. And I was vice chancellor when I was named bishop. And so I continued to be the vice chancellor at that time after I was named auxiliary bishop. But within a very short time, we redid the administrative structure of the diocese. And as I mentioned before, organized it according to regions.
Mm.
And then there were four auxiliary bishops, and each of us became a regional bishop. And so you worked outside of the chancery building much more than within the chancery building. And other people took over the kind of things that I had been doing before. And basically it was lay people that took over the work I'd been doing before. And the role became much more of a pastoral role as a bishop under the auspices of the archbishop, who was Cardinal Dearden. Each of us was the bishop for a region, and so had the pastoral responsibility for that region.
For a collection of parishes in the region?
Yes,
and
yeah.
Schools.
And there were, at that point, we had, I think, about 340 parishes. So when they got split up, you would have 75 to 90 parishes in your region.
And you had four regional bishops?
Yeah, four of us. See, and I had what was called the West Region, Bishop Shainer, the South Region, Bishop Kropchak, the East Region, I think, and Northeast Region, something like that. I didn't pay as much attention to the East side, so I'm not sure.
You were plenty busy yourself.
What they called that. But the West side, I know we just called it the West Region. And then in the South Region, which was like, at that point, it was the South included Monroe County, Washtenaw County, and what's the other county?
Lenawee,
yeah.
Because Lansing didn't break off.
Until 71.
Yeah, more regions.
Well, no, Lansing was there.
It's 37, but more, they got more territory
from
Detroit.
The two dioceses were added in 71.
Right.
And so Detroit lost those two counties.
Right.
They went to Lansing.
Right. And as West Region, your parishes were mostly in the city?
Mostly, because at that point we still had a lot of parishes left in the
right.
city.
Right.
And so between, from downtown out to Telegraph, you know, following Michigan Avenue, or, well, south of Michigan would become the South Region, you know, when you get like the Inkster and all those suburbs going west, including Dearborn, was in the South Region. And then the West Region was be like north of, actually Ford Road or Warren, and kind of following Woodward northward, and then all those northwest suburbs, you know, so it's a major part of, well, Grand River would be the main artery,
right.
And on both sides of Grand River going all the way to the end of the diocese.
All the way north through Oakland County?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It would be the West Region. And I forget what the boundary, it might have been Woodward, or, although no, Royal Oak was in my region. So I don't know exactly what.
Could be Gratiot, maybe.
Yeah, more like, yeah, Gratiot, the counterpart to Grand River.
Right.
And then Macomb County and Lapeer County and St. Clair County, that would be the Northeast region.
And they still use the regional bishops system today.
Yeah.
They've still got it. Yeah.
Yeah. The regions have changed somewhat.
Right.
And, you know, when Cardinal Dearden did it, he really allowed responsibility to be handed over. And so a regional bishop, you had serious responsibility for trying to develop parish life and trying to, oversee the work of the priests and the religious education programs and the schools, all of that.
And you got to know the parishioners too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, which they don't, can't always get to the archbishop. So you're their channel to the archbishop,
yes,
as a regional
right.
bishop.
If it had to go to the archbishop, then you would take it there. But otherwise, you were responsible for the development of past parish life.
Okay. Turning to the strike, throughout the strike, you were an auxiliary bishop for the archdiocese and pastor at St. Leo's.
Yeah.
What was the makeup of the parish community as far as strikers or replacement workers?
St. Leo?
At St. Leo's, yes.
Well, it would not have been so many strikers in St. Leo's. By that time, this neighborhood had become almost 100% black. And there would have been maybe some truck drivers and I don't think on the editorial staff of the papers.
No writers or?
No, or the writing staff. But there would have been some Teamster Union members perhaps, but not really very many. You know, by that time, the white exodus had taken place,
right.
And you know, a lot of the workers lived in Macomb County, Warren and Sterling Heights.
Right, the plant was in Sterling Heights.
Yeah, yeah, that big plan was right. Sterling Heights, mm-hmm. Right.
Were there any police officers as parishioners of the parish?
No, okay. Not in this parish, no. Because again, up until after Coleman Young came in, the police force was almost totally white.
Mm-hmm.
And he was first elected in 72. See, but all the police cars going around this neighborhood were white police officers,
right.
Which, you know, that's what really built up the tensions, or one of the main things that built up the tensions that led to the riot in 67, because it was almost like an occupying army.
Right.
I mean, they were resented by the people very often. They weren't looked upon as, you know, really asset that much. And there really turned out to be quite a bit of harsh treatment of young people, especially. I mean, the black kids were badly treated. The neighboring parish from St. Cecilia's is in between, but next one going out Grand River would be St. Teresa at Pingree, mm-hmm. And in the 10th precinct. And the pastor there was a very good friend of mine. In fact, I lived at that parish for a few years when I wasn't pastor someplace else. And there was lots of bad things that happened to kids in that area.
Well, most of the officers, they called them Copper Canyons where they lived. They had to live in the city, but they created their own community of police officers. So they didn't live in this community.
Well, yeah, see, in a big, like St. Raymond's Parish on the northeast side, mm-hmm. was filled with police officers. And on the northwest side, when you got up around well, St. Gerard, you know, that's an evergreen and 7.5 mile road, and going like South Rosedale, that would have been heavily occupied. There was a parish called St. Eugene, which was right at the corner of the northwest Detroit. Telegraph was one of the boundaries, and 8 mile, so right in that, you know, Telegraph and 8 mile, you know, the triangle that would be formed by
those. They were still in the city, but just barely.
Yeah,
in the city, the offices.
Yeah, they were in the city, and so that was heavily a police officer.
And there was a segregation between the people in the community and the officers, so that's another reason that you could be seen
as an
occupier.
They didn't share, you know, a common life in almost any sense.
They didn't live together, eat together, and pray together.
No. You know, it's very different. You know, as a kid, I remember growing up, a police officer is your friend.
Right.
You know, but black kids couldn't always count on that.
Yeah. So. Well, how did the strike impact St. Leo? Did it impact the number of parishioners or fundraising or collections or
no, there was, see, my activities as an auxiliary bishop, and or in this case regional bishop, didn't, you know, St. Leo was in my region, but my activities, you know, that were separate from being a regional bishop, I guess call social justice activities, didn't have much
impact,
overflow effect into the parish.
Okay.
You know, people were supportive of what I did, but it didn't bring people in or drive people away.
Okay. Turning to more of the major events of the strikes, the ones that more people know. On August 19th, 1995, Frank Brabeneck was kicked out at the Sterling Heights plant.
95,
by an off-duty officer. Do you remember that event, or your reaction to that event?
No. You know, but I do remember, now that, I did have a couple white who were union people, not newspaper workers, but as union people, and the he was an electrician in the electricians union, and he was got in a fracas out there at the Sterling Heights plant, and got arrested, you know, for, you know, striking somebody, you know, a fight developed somehow between, and so he was arrested. I remember his wife calling me up, and she was just panicked because he had gone out there, you know, to support the strikers, and then he got involved in it and ended up being arrested. And, you know, I think it was like on a Saturday night, and she called me Sunday morning and all upset. And they were white people and they ended up being parishioners of St. Neil's because before they were married, both of them are, she for sure, and I think he also, were students of Wayne State, and they happened to come by here and found out there was a church very close to Wayne State, and we got to know each other. And then they started to come here while they were still students, and then ended up being married here, and all their kids were baptized here at St. Leo's.
And how did everything turn out for him after his arrest?
Well, after he, you know, he got out of jail within 24 hours or so, and he had not been injured too badly, but he was injured somewhat, and you know, they you know, within the family, they settled it that he wasn't going to get into that kind of stuff anymore.
Did he describe how he was treated by because? The vent security officers out there were accused, and the Sterling Heights police were accused.
No, I don't. You know, there would be two versions of it. You know,
the truth lies somewhere in the middle.
Yeah. I mean, you know, like anything like that. You know, going back to the time you were a kid, he hit me first.
Right.
You know, and so, but he did refrained from getting into physical.
He was more afraid of his wife, probably.
Yeah. And so he did. He only got arrested that one time. And I had forgotten that they were actually parishioners here. So there were parishioners involved in supporting the strike.
Because the other unions were involved.
Yeah.
Teamsters, things like
yeah,
that.
Oh, yeah,
certainly involved in supporting.
Yeah, yeah. And as an electrician union person, he... the unions, you know, united.
Yeah, solidarity.
Yeah.
Jeannie Wiley. Wiley.
Yeah.
She was quoted, she's an organizer for Readers United with her husband, Mr. Bill. She was quoted as saying, we, the protesters, are committed to nonviolence, but we're not going to be passive. Did you witness any less passive action or any violence on behalf of the strikers?
No, I never did, no. I mean, I knew of that one incident, but I wasn't there. It happened on a Saturday night. It was late at night. And Rick didn't come home. That's why his wife was so panicked. And
she knew what was going on there, but she worried.
Yeah, and you know, and you don't. If you get arrested, you usually don't get a chance to make your one phone call for a few hours, and so there was no way for her to find out what had happened
until the morning, right?
Yeah.
On December 21st, 1995, you participated in a prayer vigil at the Detroit News building, about 4:30 p.m., which about closing time or shift change maybe. Can you describe the purpose of the prayer vigil and your participation?
Well, at that time, we were struggling to get the two sides to come together and really negotiate a settlement. And so we had a prayer vigil, you know, praying for a spirit of reconciliation and harmony and you know, to try to eliminate bitterness and the hard feelings between the two sides. And so it was intended to be a sincere effort to bring the two sides together, you know, to do it publicly. And you know, this may seem to be my bias, but it just seemed to me, and I think the documents show it, that the company really didn't make any offer that was could even be thought of as acceptable. And I don't know if this was before or after it was probably after all the outsiders were brought in, you know, the strike
breakers. The replacements, yes.
Yeah, pardon?
The replacements.
Yeah, the replacement workers. Yeah, I was thinking of the other word.
Yeah.
and that was a clear violation of the law. And so the company just wouldn't budge on any of that. And, you know, and I watched over that five-year period. I remember one of the really good writers for the news was Free Press, Kate DeSmet, and struggled so hard and was trying to do the right thing and get this settled and so on. But after two or three years, she couldn't make it anymore. I mean, so she had to move and get a job. I think out on the West Coast, she ended up in California.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I was watching that happen to other workers. And I remember going to a couple funerals of workers who died while on strike. And, you know, that was just devastating to the families, obviously. But it just seemed so cruel that, you know, the company could wait and wait and wait. And even though the courts issued determinations of conviction against the company for violating the law, they could appeal to the NLRB, and that would take 2, 3, 4 years or more.
And people are still on strike.
Yeah, and so it really became clear that the company was just waiting it out, and pretty soon the strikers would be gone.
Right.
They'd die or
they'd move for other jobs.
Get other jobs. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so that's what was happening. And so the privilege, well, I don't know what point it was, but it was probably, certainly this was going on, I don't know at that point how many had to leave, you know, just couldn't sustain the strike. But that's what was happening. So we were trying to bring a spirit of prayerfulness into the whole thing.
And get people to talk.
Yes.
Peacefully.
Right, exactly.
Okay. There were reports, now these are Detroit News reports at the time, with the prayer vigil, that said there were shouts of lowlife and rats, and other vulgar phrases, they said. And they said that one protester held a small prayer candle in one hand and with the other displayed a familiar one-finger gesture of disdain. Did you see any of that at the prayer vigil?
No, I did not. Honestly, now, you know, I suppose, you know, as one of the religious clerical people, I was up in the front, and so maybe there was things going on behind me, but I didn't remember that it had that kind of a spirit. To me, it was a genuine effort to bring a spiritual context into the whole thing, okay. And to a prayerful context.
Good. The prayer vigil was coordinated by the Interfaith Committee on Worker Issues. Can you describe the committee, its purpose, and your involvement?
There were other people that were much more active on that committee. You know, they would be the ones who would plan events and, you know, and then tell us what to do. You know, some of the, like Coma McGee or myself or some of the other religious leaders. The Interfaith Committee was an attempt to bring the religious community, Christians and Jews, and at that point we didn't have Muslims of any number, but it was, and to bring the Christian community together, but also the make it interfaith by bringing Jewish leaders into it. And so it was an attempt to show that a strike like this is an economic issue, but there's also moral questions involved. The rights of people to a job, to a fair wage, and the right to organize. And those are all rights that have been recognized in Catholic social teaching. The beginning of Catholic social teaching is usually historically marked as 1891. When Leo XIII published an encyclical letter, which is a major teaching document for the Pope. That's how the Pope would teach, basically through such encyclical letters. And encyclicals are simply worldwide. It would be to the whole world. That was called Rerum Novarum, so of new things. But it was basically on the rights of laboring people. And included in those rights, the right to organize, the right to a fair, we even use the term family wage. In other words, a worker had a right to a wage that would enable that worker to support the family. Mm-hmm. Not just a minimum wage, but a family wage. And so those are rights that were part of Catholic social teaching for sure, but also other religious groups supported the same rights and the same kind of teaching. And certainly in the Jewish tradition, that's a very strong tradition about the right of the worker to receive a fair wage. And so the attempt was to bring the religious community together and to try to highlight the fact that that this was a moral question as well as economic or political, whatever other term you might want to use, but it definitely had religious overtones or connections. And we were trying to bring that into it and appeal to the people who were Christian or Jewish or whatever to try to act out of the basis of their religious faith.
To show that we're all committed to the same thing,
yeah,
to our faith.
That's what we had hoped. Yeah.
Another coalition is the Action Coalition of Strikers and Supporters, which was established 2 weeks after the strike, July 27 of 1995. Its stated function was to build support amongst trade unionists, the community, and religious groups. What was your role in this coalition?
What's the name of that one?
It's the Action Coalition for Strikers and Supporters, ACOS.
I don't remember.
Not too much connection.
Being part of that in any significant way.
Okay.
Most of my contacts and my efforts were with United Religious Leaders, whatever we...
The Interfaith Committee. Interfaith Committee?
Yeah, okay. That one. Yeah.
And they listed, the Interfaith Committee listed St. Leo's phone number, I saw, as a contact information, the phone number for St. Leo Parish.
Did they
hold any meetings or any rallies at the parish that you know of?
Some, but it wasn't a major meeting place, but I recall, and I was here at the time, so... No, I don't think so.
Okay. I wanted to turn now to the events of March 6th of 1996. There was a protest at the Detroit News building that you attended, which you were arrested at that protest. Can you describe the situation? It started about 7:30 in the morning.
Yeah, well, I think we started with a prayer service of some sort,
mm-hmm.
and then we blocked the entrance to the building, were disturbing the peace, violating private property, I guess. And so that's when we got arrested, a number of us. I don't know.
24 was what I read.
Yeah, it was 20-something, I knew that.
Including Marianne Mahaffey?
Yes.
Who was Detroit City Council President at the time. Do you remember any of the other arrestees?
Well, wasn't Coleman McGee in there?
I believe he was.
Yeah, he was one of them. And Rabbi Richard Hertz, maybe?
Okay.
Because those are the same people I worked with on the Michigan Coalition for Human Rights,
mm-hmm.
that I think started a little bit later. We had determined that we had to call more attention to what was going on and to... Again, bring emphasis to the point that these are moral issues that we're dealing with. And so we wanted to emphasize that they're so important that we'd be willing to get arrested as a sign of our protest, you know, make it something very concrete, visible, physical. Involvement.
And I read reports that protesters wore armbands, and there were different colored armbands for the folks who got arrested. Was it predetermined who might be arrested?
I presume it was, but because usually in those kinds of events, there's planning ahead of time, and you know what to do when you are arrested. You know, not to fight back or, you know, resist arrest in any way. And so people are prepared for what's going to happen. And so usually those who are going to be arrested have decided ahead of time. And so you kind of empty your pockets to make sure
right.
you don't have to, you know, not carrying too much. You had to have your ID, but that's about all you needed.
Okay.
And so... I've been in some arrest situations like that where people deliberately do not even have their ID just to make it more difficult for the civil authorities to do anything about you. And so, I don't remember wearing different armbands, but I'm sure those who were to be arrested had predetermined that. Now, I've also been at events where somebody at the last minute decides, I'm going to get in this too,
mm-hmm.
and become one of the people arrested. That happened, but in this case, as far as I know, it was just those who had prepared for arrest.
Well, and there was a little difficulty with the, they brought a bus, from what I read, and the bus needed a jump start. They had to call a tow truck in and give the police bus a jump start. There's an image I saw of Marianne Mahaffey, who's giving an interview out of the bus window. So that brought a little more attention and gave you an opportunity to speak.
Yeah, I remember seeing that picture.
And there were a couple of fists, I think, coming out of the bus window, too.
Yeah.
It's a good picture.
Yeah.
And this was organized by Readers United,
mm-hmm.
The rally. What was the purpose of Readers United?
It was the by the name, the indication is that these are ordinary people who buy the newspaper that and read it, and we don't like what's going on with the newspaper that is being provided to us by what's going on by the people who run that newspaper. And so as readers, and if we could get enough Readers United, you know, it really would have an economic impact on the paper, because we would refuse to buy the paper and instead would buy the alternative paper that was produced by the union members. And so that was the idea, to have enough readers to have an impact. Now, you know, it never really got were to a large enough number of acknowledged readers refusing to take the paper to have the impact we wanted. It didn't dramatically change things, but I'm sure it had a significant enough impact on the business people that they might think about what they're doing.
The advertisers and things.
Yeah, but ultimately it did not. You know, the economic impact for them wasn't large enough to cause them to really negotiate.
They were pretty steadfast.
Yes.
The attorneys for creations.
Very definitely so.
On March 7th, 1996, the next day, in the Detroit Journal, John Lippert wrote, "Detroit Free Press and News sought to portray striking workers as misguided and violent." He continued that the strikers' supporters fought against that image Wednesday, the day that the morning you were arrested, with dignified and peaceful protests at the Detroit News building. How would you describe the strike? We said before that usually the truth lies somewhere in the middle. It's described by the news and the free press as misguided and violent and dignified and peaceful in the Detroit Journal.
Well, my recollection of what happened that day was certainly dignified and peaceful. Now, you know, I might have missed some people, but besides, you know, the ones actively involved in the protest and being arrested, there was a large number of people there, and they would not necessarily all be supporting the action or the strikers. And, you know, as in, I've had this happen in, you know, anti-war protests where the government puts people in the crowd, even to provoke.
Right.
And, you know, and that happened. Now, I don't know if it happened in that instance or not, but I don't remember that there was any kind of or any great deal violence or...
And it was over fairly quickly, about an hour.
Yeah, right.
But certainly by 9 o'clock it was over.
Right, because we wanted to get processed and back to work.
and what was the experience? Once they got the bus and took you to the police station, how long was that process?
Well, not very long, as I recall. I mean, I've been in other situations where you're in a holding cell for hours, but they got us over to the courthouse, I guess it was, and, you know, wrote out, basically, it's a ticket. They write out a ticket, you know, disturbing the peace, and you pay a fine, and it's all over. So there wasn't any big holdup. They handled it quite well at the police department or the courthouse, wherever it was.
Your participation in the strike drew a lot of attention. There's a quote I read from a spokesman for the Archdiocese of Detroit. They weren't named, but he said, "Bishop Gumbleton frequently does things for Bishop Gumbleton. He does not represent the Archdiocese." How do you think the Archdiocese felt about your participation?
Well, the communications director was very opposed to it. I don't know if you're avoiding names or not.
You're welcome to name names.
Well, that was Ned McGrath, and he was a former newscaster for NBC.
WDIV, I believe. WDIV, the local station?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. And he was much more sympathetic to the company than he was to the strikers. And he certainly was not very sympathetic to what I was doing. And Carter Maida was in between. He certainly never tried to stop me or told me I was doing the wrong thing. But just the tone of the things that Ned McGrath put out, he was implying that I was on my own in sort of a freelance.
A renegade bishop.
Yeah, activist. But I never, from people who were, superiors, like the Archbishop, I never was once reprimanded or told it's better not to do it. So, and I, he said I did it on my own. Well, I did it as, on my own, but also as a Catholic bishop. And I feel like I was well formed in Catholic teaching about moral issues, and so had a right and a responsibility to try to teach those principles of Catholic social justice morality.
Which had been expressed for more than 100 years at that point.
Yeah, oh yeah, right. Yeah, and and that wasn't the last word on it. The 1930, there was a second encyclical that was a follow-up to Rerum Novarum. Well, it was 1931, it was 40 years later, Quadragesimo Anno, that Pius XI published, that reiterated that teaching. And then there wasn't a whole lot during Pius XII, but under Paul VI and John Paul II, there was a very, well, because the Vatican Council intervened in 61 to 63. Well, I should mention John the 23rd. He wrote a very important encyclical letter called Mater et Magistra, Mother and Teacher. And it was about the social justice issues. And, then the council came along and the document on the church in the modern world insisted that the church had to be involved in the issues of the world in which we live and try to bring the light of God's teaching into the situations that were going on in the world. And then Paul VI and John Paul II wrote very strong, clear letters that taught, it was a constant reiteration of Catholic social teaching on all of these issues. And that continues to this day. So I felt I was doing what a bishop is supposed to do. Every minister is a teacher, but a special role of the bishop is to teach.
Right.
And so I just felt I was doing what I was called to do as a bishop, the leadership in this area of Catholic teaching.
And you had support, it sounds like, from Cardinal Maida.
Well, I wouldn't call it active support.
Well, he didn't.
No, he didn't do anything to stop me. But he never, on the other hand, patted me on the back and said, good work.
He had to be careful publicly about saying anything.
Yeah, right.
He's the leader of millions of Catholics here in the diocese. You spoke earlier about the encyclicals. And in March of 91, the United States Catholic Conference spoke about Senate Bill 55. Bishop Frank Rademer, who was Bishop of Patterson, said it's especially appropriate for the Conference of Catholic Bishops to speak out on the issue at this time. It was the 100-year anniversary of Rerum Novarum. And he said, Pope Leo XIII pointed out that workers' associations should be protected by the state since they can be beneficial not just for the workers they represent, but for the stability of society. The late Cardinal John O'Connor, who was Archbishop of New York, also said that collective bargaining, management knew that they could replace workers, that collective bargaining could be a charade and the right to strike a mockery they knew that they could permanently replace workers. And given this precedent, were you surprised at any negative reaction you received?
For your actions? See, there's another one that I said John Paul II, but one of the really important ones he wrote in Cinco was Centesimus Annus, which is the 100th anniversary of Rerum Novarum. And so that came out in 1991. And that's a very, very powerful teaching document. And I use it a lot, but not so much for social justice issues, but anti-war. I mean, that's where he says clearly, I myself, on the occasion of the recent tragic war in the Persian Gulf, repeated the cry, never again war. And he tried to prevent that first Persian Gulf war. See, and it had just ended when he published this encyclical. You know, the ground war had gone on for about 6 weeks after the air war had gone on the previous 6 weeks. And he said, I repeated that cry, and he gave reasons why we have to say no to war. See, and so I use that a lot, but also in that same encyclical letter, he reiterated again these teachings, the 100 years of Catholic social teaching saying the same thing. But now the big problem was that I remember a letter I got from some person challenging me on what I was saying. How could you say this? I was raised Catholic and this was not what I ever learned. And that was a tragedy because the teachings are there, they're very clear, but we haven't been successful in, getting the teachings disseminated among the Catholic population very effectively.
From the Pope to the parishioners.
Yes, or through the school system. We had a marvelous system of schools, but we did not teach. And I'd find it very discouraging that, someone who had gone to Catholic elementary school, Catholic high school, Catholic university, maybe graduate studies, and they know nothing about the social justice teaching of the church. And they talk and act against it because they, and maybe some of them would leave the church if they knew the actual teaching.
Yeah.
Because they said, I don't agree with that. I'm not going to.
If people would say that you were politically motivated, but it wasn't a political motivation, was it? It was a moral motivation.
Exactly. Right. Totally. I mean, sometimes moral questions are also political questions because we, in our society, we implement laws that bear on social justice issues. And so there's a mix, and that's why we sometimes, if you're trying to get across some moral teaching, you also do lobbying in the Congress, or like Bishop Bodimer was testifying before some committee or other when he did that. Mm-hmm. And he did it on behalf of the U.S. bishops, but at the same time, Pope John Paul II had issued what I think of as an even stronger statement. See, and not too long before that, we had also, the U.S. Catholic bishops, had published a pastoral letter on the economy. I forget the name of it right now. But we call it the Economics Pastoral in 1986. And in that pastoral letter, we set forth some of the same teachings, all of the same teachings, but in not as much detail even as the papal teachings, but that economics pastoral letter was based on this 100 years of Catholic social teaching. And so it was designed to be a way of bringing papal teaching into the U.S. church and passed a letter by the U.S. bishops, ideally would be disseminated throughout the country with every parish teaching the, in their religious ed programs and their schools and in, from the pulpit. Mm-hmm. But that kind of follow through
has not happened. It got lost somewhere along the way, huh?
Yeah, it stops.
Well, there was a cartoon published in 1996. I don't know if you remember it. I brought it with me.
You mean the confessional?
Yes.
Oh, yes. I have that in a frame hanging in my room at home.
Well, what was your reaction at the time to the cartoon?
Well, I thought it was kind of pathetic in a way. You know, just using... well, I didn't think it was effective. You know, I'm sure the cartoonist thought it was very clever. I just, in one sense, I smiled at it and just thought, this is ridiculous that people would think somehow I would be doing that in the confessional. But it was, you know, not something laughable, actually, because... it was an attack against something very sacred.
Absolutely.
It was suggesting that a sacrament, which is a very important moment in people's lives, would be diminished to the point that you would be trying to get across a personal effort or, you know, something, you, a personal commitment that you wanted to carry out through the sacrament. Well, I mean, to me, that's... wrong is nowadays, you know, the other way we misuse the sacrament sometimes is as a penalty for people. You can't go to communion if you don't do this or that. And, you know, that the sacraments aren't prizes that belong to the church that we can give out or take away and should not be mocked in that way either.
Which is what's what it was. It had the newsboys walking away saying what?
Yeah.
You told them to burn in hell for delivering the newspaper, and you were a newsboy as a young kid.
Right.
So, was there any impact on your support from the church or from parishioners as a result of that comment? Did anything change for levels of support?
For me? Mm-hmm. Or because of that kind
of... Because of the comment, yeah.
No, I think even Catholics that didn't agree with me felt that was insulting to a sacrament. You know, it was not quite blasphemy, but it was verging on that.
Yeah.
That you're doing something with a sacrament that is, for people, something very sacred, very personal, very intimate even, and you're using it to mock.
So it maybe had a negative, the opposite impact that...
Yeah, I think it did. You know, didn't turn anything around, but
right.
But it offended people who did not agree with me, but who were Catholic.
Right. Larry Wright was the cartoonist. Did he ever apologize to you for it?
No, I never knew him. I got to know Bill Day very well, but he was Free Press, I think.
This was News, yes.
News, yeah. But I never knew him, never... Good. Was in contact with him.
Did the News ever apologize for it?
No.
Did you think you were owed an apology? Hmm? Did you feel you were owed an apology?
Well, I wrote a letter to Mr. Giles at the time, indicating, but I never got an answer.
No response. Okay. Readers also wrote to the paper in the editorial section. One woman said, "It's a shame that in this day and age, with the shortage of priests, that Bishop Gumbleton is marching his sheep around the Detroit News instead of spreading the word of the Lord. He cannot be both a priest and a politician." And another person wrote, "Bishop Gumbleton seems possessed of a distorted interpretation of Christ's message of tranquility and rectitude. He evidently sees no consistency between intimidation, violence, and threats, and Christ's dictum of harmony, forbearance, and benevolence. Frightening and intimidating workers, blocking gates and damaging vehicles are not concordant with the guiding principles of the church. The fact that this has escaped a religious leader of such eminence is disappointing and disheartening." Did you read those editorials at the time, or
no?
How do you feel about things like that?
Well, obviously, you know, people that would write that way have a limited understanding of how you teach, for one thing. Look how Pope Francis has been teaching, not through words. He hasn't published any encyclical letter yet, but just by the way he's acting. I mean, and it's affecting not just Catholics, it's everybody. Talks about, you know, how he simplified, you know, such an almost ridiculous thing like not wearing red Prada shoes. You know, why, you know, that's something that, you know, grabs people's attention, because it does seem to be just out of, you know, the context of Jesus, you know, one around in sandals and bare feet half the time, you know, that a pope would be identified by his red shoes. But when Suze Francis discards that, everybody's almost is like, yay, that's the way it should be. Mm-hmm. And so he's teaching by what he's doing, going and kneeling down in front of people in jail, young people in jail, and washing their feet, kissing their feet. That he's teaching by his action. And that's much more powerful than words. And so to complain because I'm involved in a protest, I see that as being a doer of the word rather than a hearer only. You can hear it, take it in, and it goes nowhere. But if you hear it, take it in, and let it change your life, it might change your actions. So I feel that's a way of teaching. And then, it's, you know, and I never did engage in any violence or support any kind of violent action. But I also am aware that in the Gospels, Jesus did actions too. You know, and that turning over the tables of the money changers and, you know, knocking those down. And it was because he was acting against an injustice. And these people were being cheated. And right within the temple precincts, you've made the house of God a den of thieves. That's how Jesus criticized the people doing it. And they were people, you know, part of the temple staff that he was acting against. And so to say that actions are, you know, that nobody should do actions, or that you'd never do an action that's going to confront somebody. You know, the idea that everything is going to always be tranquil and peaceful, not when you are proclaiming the truth. There are times that people don't want to hear that, and they react against that. And yet Jesus came. I came to bring fire on earth, or not peace. I mean, those are his words. And I came to bring conflict, and not, you know. And what he meant by that is you can have a false peace where you just kind of gloss over everything, pretend it's not happening or that there's no disagreement here. But if you confront and get down to the issues, and then you resolve those, then you will have genuine peace. And so that's what Jesus was doing. And that's what we have to do too as a teacher in the church. I should say I have to do as a teacher.
But certainly as a bishop. Just because you become a bishop doesn't mean you slow down at all. You get more active, you should, I think.
Well, yeah. And because in a sense you're teaching at a little broader level. Right. You know, in the parish, when I was in the parish, I was teaching within those parish boundaries, basically, through preaching on Sunday, teaching in the religious ed program, teaching in the school, the high school, the grade school. So I was doing that within that framework of the parish where I had been assigned. But then as you become a bishop and your responsibility is broader, then you have to teach on a broader level.
We've got more people to speak to.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
I'd like to finish by asking your impressions of the strike. Some people see it as having a positive influence, or some people see it as a failure. How do you feel the outcome of the strike?
I think it was a failure. Certainly the strikers lost. So many of them, their jobs are gone. They took jobs with lesser pay, less good circumstances. Many had to move, you know, which is a big thing. You move your family out of an area where you've been living. And some died during the time of the strike. So, you know, the workers truly lost, but the newspapers did too. I mean, they're not anywhere like they were as a newspaper. When I was peddling the Detroit News, it was a thick newspaper and had lots of, not just all ads, it was really, I mean, it, you know, now it's almost like the papers are like the shopping news, which used to be peddled, you know, was thrown on everybody's porch. But it was all just all ads, you know, and that, you look in the newspaper now, and they have very few reporters on the scene. You know, they use wire service and have a few columnists, but not, I don't think the caliber, you know, now I was a kid, but so I'm maybe not in a position to judge, but I used to love H.G. Selsinger. He wrote the sports column for the Detroit News. And I would always read that the first thing when I was, I started reading the sports pages when I was about 5 or 6 years old. And I grew up with H.G. Selsinger. But, you know, and of course, looking back, maybe he's no better than anybody now. I have no idea, really. But I don't think they have the number and the caliber of columnists and writers that were there before. And this is true of newspapers across the country. They're just, it's almost like they're going out of existence because of all the other ways people communicate today.
Social media and everything online.
You know, 24-hour news. Newspapers are behind.
Yeah.
By the time they end up on your porch, they're already out of date.
Yeah.
Even if you're getting a daily paper.
Well, Pastor Bill Wiley Kellerman said about the strike, another student for this project interviewed him, that he felt it was a good example of nonviolence. This is a positive outcome by the unions, a positive example of nonviolence by the unions to solve the strikes. Do you agree with him?
Yes, I do, except that and I guess, you know, he's probably thinking in terms of nonviolence as a religious action. And so you're not, you don't use nonviolence to achieve, it's not a tactic. It's simply supposed to be a way of saying the truth. You don't have it as a tactic trying to get what you want. And so in that sense, it did show what Jesus did by his nonviolent actions. And that you transform the world through love rather than through force. And that if you're going to transform anybody's life, it's going to be through love, nonviolence, active love. That's what nonviolence is, active love. And that's the most powerful force there is for transformation. And so as an example of basically nonviolent or active love, effective in the sense that it showed how Jesus would act, not how you manipulate to get your way. See, and that's so. But if you're really talking about success for the workers or for the company, both lost, and I think lost on a large scale. And we really don't have a Detroit News anymore, or a Detroit Free Press. It's, scattered all over, but I mean, the sources aren't from within Detroit, and it doesn't cover Detroit news well at all. I mean, what's going on in the city.
And did you have, you had a subscription, I'm sure, before the strike, and how about during or after?
I never had a subscription. Okay. I always bought, partly because I travel a lot, and so if I they'd pile up in my porch and they'd know I was away, so not always a good thing when you live on 15th and Grand River. So, no, I never had a subscription, but I would buy it. I became a Free Press reader much more than a news after I grew up. As a kid, we got the news delivered at home, and I delivered the news. And so that was my paper before I went to high school. But later on, see, the Free Press was only a morning paper back then. Right. You had to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to peddle your papers. And so I had this much better deal of 3 blocks, 100 customers, make about $10 or $12 a week.
And you could sleep in a little.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah, you did it after school.
Right. Well, do you read the news of the Free Press now? Do you read either paper now?
Not on a regular basis. I do read the Free Press probably more often, but not on a regular basis. I read a national paper. Okay.
Well, and knowing what you know now about the outcome of the strike and the impact it had on the workers and the community, would you have done anything differently?
I couldn't have done much differently, but I think the major flaw in the whole system was the lack of enforcement of National Labor Relations Board decisions, and that law should be changed. And a long time ago, the union should have made that a major project to change it so that employers couldn't, without any damage being done to them, they could do it with total impunity, just ignore court decisions, you know, that would come down. That we need that kind of, if unions are going to be successful when they strike, you either have to have a totally popular cause, or you have to make sure that decisions are able to be enforced. See, that's what the unions were up against. Yeah, those decisions were ignored, taken into court, and then just put on a docket that would take years to reach that case. So it didn't work. But it seems that people don't pay much attention to the rights of laboring people until a tragedy happens. You know, like Bangladesh now, over 700 people in that building that collapsed. And so now the corporations are jumping around a little bit to say, oh, we're changing this, we're gonna, you know, but you know, if you use something like that to really go after the corporations and, you know, get public opinion mobilized, because, you know, obviously that's criminal what happened, but it's happened in this country too, and not exactly the same. Well, we did have the terrible, fire way back at the beginning of the 20th century.
The textile workers.
Yeah, the people locked in sewing. But those kinds of sweatshops are around the world. I mean, I've been protesting those in other countries too. But it's hard to get people behind that. Again, as I say, when a tragedy happens, people say, oh, that is wrong. You know, why would anybody force people to work in a building that has cracks in the walls that you can see? And it was, yeah, but those things die out so quick. You know, the reaction dissipates in a matter of a few weeks.
Not if we keep talking about it. Not if we keep talking about
No, that's right. If you could really mobilize something out of that. But it's very hard,
right?
Because all the money's on the other side.
Well, Bishop Gumbleton, I want to thank you for your participation in the project. It was very insightful.
Oh, well, good. I feel good about doing it. It made me look through all my files and see what I had. And there's a couple, I found a couple letters that were in there that were all typed out, ready to be signed, and it looked like I never signed them and sent them. One was to Mr. Giles. I don't know why I didn't send it, but it wouldn't have done any good anyway. I don't think.
So,